So welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
I'm Max.
I'm Jules.
And we're here to talk about How to Lie with Statistics, our favorite book ever.
Sure. Okay, so we read from chapter 1 to chapter 3, I believe.
Yeah. Up to chapter 4. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. Though at some points it seemed a little bit hard to follow. The author kind of kept doubling back onto, like, different stories that he was talking about.
I agree.
Like, after he would change the subject to something else.
I felt like he did that a lot in chapter one.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the beginning he started talking about the mean, the average mean of...
The Yale
men's income. Yeah. So when he was talking about that, he all of a sudden just moved on to, like, the average income in a neighborhood, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, they change it up during, like, at first they could say it's, like, I think he said, like, 20,000 or 30,000 a year. And then he switched it up to, like, 3,000 a year. And he started talking about how average can mean three different things. It can mean mean, median, and mode. And I heard that before, but I see it's interesting to see people use it in the real world. And it's like,
yeah,
you're kind of lying, but you're kind of not lying.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking about it. Like, you know, I feel like we see statistics all the time, like in the news or you know, wherever. And it's like, this is the average of, you know, this group of people, but they never actually say which average it is.
Right. So basically it was just like, you have to kind of like guesstimate which one is he's talking about.
Yeah, right.
And then he went on to like the test of heads and tails. No, that's chapter 3, my bad.
Yeah, chapter 2 I think was the neighborhood.
Oh, was it?
Yes. Yeah, that's the average income is 15,000, but then the average income is 3,500.
Yeah, and then he started talking about the median.
Yeah.
And how, like, there's, like, a bunch of people that's above this median and a bunch
mm-hmm.
of people below it. And it's kind of, like, it could be a good thing when it comes to, like, employees, but it's also can be confusing because, like, he started talking about, like, some different examples with, like, oh, like, this person is getting this small percent, but this one person is getting all of this money, but it makes sense. Like,
right.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of interesting when he was talking about how the bias is, like, built into the sample space. Like, he was giving the example of, like, you know, someone's assigned to a street corner to, like, do surveys.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, two people are walking down the street. One is, like, clean cut and, like you know, just regular looking. And one is, like drunk and, like, stumbling down the street yelling.
Right.
Like, he would obviously ask the cleaner cut person.
Right.
Like, but I guess, you know, that kind of skews the data. Like, he asked someone that's, you know, I mean, I don't know what the study would be, but.
Well, they actually did a study. The one where, like, they had a group of African-American talkers and Caucasian talkers,
mm-hmm.
asking black people questions. And, like it was funny how to see they answered in a different way. I don't know. I don't remember if they said they got these group of African-American people from the same area or
mm-hmm.
different area. But I thought it was interesting to see how they answered in a different way. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to find a quote.
Yeah, I'm looking for one right now. So, would it be any wonder if, when answering the question with connotations of disloyalty in wartime, a Southern black would tell a white man what sounded good rather than what he actually believed? Is it also possible that the different groups of interviewers chose different kinds of people to talk to? I guess, you know, that also skews some of the data. Like,
yeah,
like that makes sense. Like, that someone would say an answer that they think is the right answer instead
mm-hmm.
of what they actually believe,
right.
because, you know, I guess during World War II, like, you know, it wasn't really very even ground.
Yeah.
This book is actually pretty old. Like, it was written in 1954, which kind of, you know, sheds light on, like, the neighborhood incomes. Because, like, you know, they're talking about how much money $25,000 is.
Right.
And, like, now, like, with inflation and all that, like, that's not really that much. Like,
yeah.
They're talking about $25,000 being, like, you know, a business executive's
right.
salary. Like,
So I would like to talk about chapter 3, I think.
Chapter 3?
Because okay. I was a little, I think that was the part I was more confused on than any other part.
Okay.
Because they started talking about the toothpaste company.
Right. Yeah.
And, oh, okay. So they were talking about, like, how many, I think it's the percentage of usage
mm-hmm.
or how well it works, I'm thinking. I think it's how well it works. And then they started talking about how falsehood was going on, like how they're lying, but it's not really a lie the way they work.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of interesting, but I was kind of like confused on, like, what are you talking about? And then they just went to, oh, heads and tails for pennies. Just like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think that one was like about the side. Like, it seemed like he was trying to talk a lot about like the size of the sample space. Like, because the penny example, there's only 10 pennies that he's tossing.
Right.
And heads comes up 8 times.
Yeah.
So his thing is, it says, you know, in the little picture, it's like, science proves that tossed pennies come up heads 80% of the time.
That's true. Or is it?
Or is it, right? Yeah. Yeah, right. So, like, I guess you have to, they're just trying to say, like, sometimes statistics are, like, measured wrongly.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. It kind of got me thinking, maybe, well, now that was explained, maybe it was, like, they were using a penny as an example for mm-hmm. the toothpaste, because, like, they could have just tested a small group of people with the toothpaste, and, like, maybe 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 8 of those people said, oh, this toothpaste really works. And then 2 of those people said, oh, no, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that could have been, like, maybe that's his example.
Yeah.
And it does make sense, because then they can say, oh, 80% of the people, this toothpaste works 80%.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah, another example that uses the the polio vaccination one, where 450 children in a community were vaccinated and 680 were left unvaccinated as controls. Shortly after the community was visited by an epidemic, not one of the vaccinated children contracted a recognizable case of polio, but neither did any of the controls. What the experimenters had overlooked or not understood in setting up their project was the low incidence of paralytic polio. At the usual rate, only 2 cases would have been expected in a group this size. So this is the people that
right.
planned this experiment sort
yeah.
of planned it badly, so there would be really no meaning anyway, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and then they went on the next page, they went to talk about the housing. How
mm-hmm.
so it says together too much of recent American housing, for instance, has a plan to fit the statistically average family of 3.6 persons. Translated into reality, this means 3 or 4 persons, which in turn means 2 bedrooms. And this size family average, though it is, actually makes a minority of all family. We build average houses for average families, said the builders, and neglect the majority that are larger or smaller. Found that interesting because right now I'm like looking for an apartment, and like there's mostly 2 bedroom apartments,
mm-hmm.
and like you can rarely find a 3 bedroom or a 4 bedroom or a 1 bedroom apartment. And I found that kind of interesting because that's basically what they are doing. They're just building 2 bedroom houses because that's the average amount of family, 3.6. So all you need is 2 bedrooms. So
right.
Kind of see that in real life right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a cool perspective. I guess. Oh, it looks like we're almost out of time for this.
Yes, we are.
This segment of How to Lie with Statistics
by Darnell Huff.
By Darnell Huff with Jules and Max.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning in.
See you like next week, I think.
See you next week. Yeah.
Next week. Bye.
Bye. So, hello everyone. Welcome to this week's installment of How to Lie with Statistics. I'm Max.
I'm Jules.
And today we're going to be talking about chapters 4 through 8.
Yes. You want to start off or?
You can start off.
I can start off.
What did you notice?
Okay, so let's just talk about the first chapter. Chapter 4. So, they started talking about the IQ tests. Their example was Peter's and Linda's IQ. Peter had an IQ of 98 and Linda had an IQ of 101. So, basically, they were like, oh, there's errors in some when they do the IQ tests results. There's sometimes errors. So, they were like, maybe Peter got three more points than what he actually got, and maybe he had three points less than what he got.
Right.
And maybe Linda's the same, so maybe they're higher than what the IQ said they are, or maybe they're just lower.
Right. Yeah. There was like that 3-point
system. Yeah.
The 3-point error system. So you know they could have been on the same plane.
Right.
But they could have been opposites, I guess.
Yeah. And this actually got me to think about. Because we're seniors, we already took the SATs and the ACTs. Maybe this could be true for that too. Maybe
there's that percent error.
Yeah.
But that's a test that like you actually have to answer like questions to. Like I think the IQ test is like it's not really the same because like it tests like how intelligent you are, not just like how well you can answer the questions.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
It talks about like how the test like doesn't really take into
mm-hmm.
account like leadership or creative imagination
mm-hmm.
or other things like personality matters.
Right.
So it's I don't know. It seems like a more subjective version of the ACT or the SAT that just kind of scales you, gives you an IQ score that's like. Sort of predetermined by someone, like, oh, they're probably this smart, like, this is their score.
I can agree with that.
And then later in that chapter, they were talking about the cigarettes, and how a scientific laboratory tested the smoke from, like, a bunch of different brands of cigarettes and wanted to see which ones were like the least harmful giving the nicotine and other chemical content of each cigarette brand. And they found that there wasn't really, there was virtually no difference, between the different brands. But you know, on that scale, it says that there's gotta be one at the bottom of like the least stuff.
Yeah.
And that one was old gold.
Wonderful cigarette name.
Right. Great name. So that one got advertised a lot as, like, the least harmful.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because there's not, there's not really any difference.
Right.
So
I guess it's time we can move on to chapter 5, right?
Yeah,
chapter 5. Okay, so chapter 5, basically, they were talking about how graphs can deceive people, deceive what the actual result is.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes something look way more dramatic when it really, it's really not that big. So one thing they were talking about is cutting off like half of the graph to make that line be more defined.
Yeah.
And let me see, what's their example? They had an example of 1 minute. Oh, I can't find it.
They had a bunch of examples. I think their main thing, like this graph here with the weird guy standing behind it, like, you know, it doesn't start from zero.
Right.
Like, they just kind of
it starts
take,
like
they just take
money.
A section of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they on the next page they actually show it cut off.
Yeah.
And then now it looks it looks way more big of a deal than the first one.
Right.
Where it was the full thing and now it's this is like less than half of it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, look how the increase happened. Or how they stretch it a little bit.
Yeah,
to
and the
make
next
it, like
right.
Like very, very defined. They want a pretty shape, is what he call it.
Yeah.
A shape where like it either increases dramatically or looks like it increases dramatically or decreases dramatically. And I found
right.
that pretty interesting.
Yeah, it looks like it's like all about the scale. Like you see
yeah.
out here, it's like every 2 billion.
Right.
And here it's like every 0.2 billion.
Right. Like
yeah.
We're gonna do whatever we can to make it seem longer.
Yeah,
and
right.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And it's like the same information. It's just how it's
definitely is the same information.
It's just how it's displayed to
basically.
You.
Basically.
And
yeah.
I guess for me, like if I wasn't reading this book and
mm-hmm.
I just saw this graph that with the every 0.2 billion, I'd be like,
right.
wow, like, these prices are like fluctuating like so much, like oh my god, like that's crazy.
So I'm sorry, I do remember the example. The example was the government payrolls
right.
go up,
mm-hmm.
and wherein actually it doesn't go up, it actually stays stable,
mm-hmm.
Because it only went up. I believe it went up like I think it just went from 19 million to 20 million.
Yeah.
And like they were like, oh, it just dramatically increased, but when it actually what it actually did was just it just went up a
it just went
million.
Up a small amount.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So chapter 6.
Yeah, chapter 6. This one was interesting. It was also a chapter about graphs. They talk about how bar graphs are like the oldest form of like, you know, a picture graph. Like
right.
here they show a small, like the example is that it is, you know, the wage of a worker, of a carpenter in the United States versus a carpenter in some country that's, I don't think is real. And it's represented by a guy and like a huge stack or
right.
a huge bag of money that is only, they say that it's only twice as much as the other guy, but they mentioned that because it's like a three-dimensional object that they're representing it with,
yeah.
like it gets twice as tall and also twice as wide, so it occupies four times as much area.
Yeah. I consider that very interesting because, well, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, if it's twice, like, all right, what I don't understand is, like, if it's four times as wide, I mean, four times the area,
mm-hmm.
do they fold it up to for that four times of the area, or do they fold it up to the twice of the area?
What do you mean?
So, like, if, okay, so,
I think this is just, like, a representation, like, a graphical representation, like,
mm-hmm.
for a reader, like, if it's, like, in a magazine, like, this is America, like this is some other country, like the this one with the steel capacity,
mm-hmm.
it talks about how there was only a 50% increase given,
mm-hmm.
but it was drawn as a 150% increase,
mm-hmm.
To give a visual impression.
Mm-hmm. So, what I'm trying to say is, like, if it's four times the area, won't they, like, lower the amount of money they put into it, just fill up that four, I don't know what I'm talking. Sorry.
I think that it's not actually filled with money, but that's just how they're representing it.
Okay.
You know, like, so
okay.
the actual number is only twice as much, but
okay.
the visual, like, pictures,
yeah.
it happens to be twice as, or four times as large.
Okay. So they talked about it with the cows and the rhinos, too.
Yeah.
So
sort of same thing again and again.
Yeah. So chapter 7. Just a semi-attached figure.
Yeah.
In this chapter, they talked about
Yeah, it starts out and they're talking about how, you know, a certain type of cold medicine kills 30,000 germs in a test tube in less than 11 seconds. And they, you know, they represent it with like a doctor in a white coat in a laboratory with, the, with his graph, and you know, there's a photo and all this stuff. It looks really great, but it's not. You know, they don't take all the things into account. Like they don't.
Yeah, and then they talk about like because they gave a percentage. It says 27% of a large sample of enemas.
Eminent.
Eminent physician smoke throaties more than any other brand. So they were like this is information, but it's not useful information.
Right.
And this was this is what makes it a semi attached figure, because this information is there, but what does it actually mean? Why is this information important?
Yeah.
Is basically what they're trying to say. So then they go on to figure to talk about that more, and so they go on to talk about that more, and I guess what they were basically saying is that information is really nothing. Like it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't make this medicine better than any other medicine that you find in your pharmacy or whatever.
Yeah, it's all just kind of marketing.
Basically,
they're just trying to trick people. Oh my, look at the time. I think we might be out of time for this week's podcast.
Yeah.
Stay tuned next week for the final installment of How to Lie with Statistics with Max and Jules.
By Darren Huff.
By Darren Huff. thank you. Hello, everyone. Welcome to How to Lie with Statistics with Max and Jules.
Hello. In this session, we are answering some of our viewers' questions. The first question or statement or command is by Mr. Miles, and he is telling us to choose one of the quotations inside of the front cover and discuss how it relates to the intro. So the first quotation we're going to use is... there are three kinds of lies. Lies, demanded lies, and statistics. So, lies, basically a lie is something, transforming the true to something that's
not true.
Basically.
Yeah, a falsehood.
A demand lie is, I guess you would call that, like, a lie that is forced, I guess?
I guess, yeah.
I guess a forced lie. And then a statistics lie is basically rearranging the number, or saying numbers mean something when they don't, or showing that numbers mean something when they really don't.
Yeah.
So.
We have some more questions coming from Mark Miles.
So the next is, put the second paragraph on page 18 into your own words.
I can handle that one. So the second paragraph on page 18 is about a river. So it starts off saying, a river, as we are told, cannot rise above its source. But it can seem to if there's a pumping station concealed somewhere about it. It is equally true that the result of the sampling study is no better than the sample it is based on, and so on and so forth. This kind of analogy is sort of just... comparing the two, you know, a river can't be higher up on ground than the lake that it is sourced from. But it can seem like it if there's a pumping station. And that's kind of the same thing as, you know, data collected in a sample can seem one way instead of another, depending on how you manipulate the data and how you change it around and display it to show what it really means and what it, I guess, doesn't mean. So that's what paragraph 2 on page 18 means.
So the next question is by Mr. Miles. What is the advantage of a stratified random sample, and what difficulties does it propose according to this chapter?
Yeah, so stratifying populations when you sample them is sort of just, you know, dividing them up into different sections. And I'm sorry, what was the question again?
The question is, what is the advantage of a stratified random sample, and what difficulties does it pose according to the chapter?
If a population, well, okay, here's an example. If a population, if population density varies greatly in a region, stratifying a sample will ensure that the estimates are made accurately in different parts of the region, and that the comparisons between the regions can be made with equal statistical power. For example, maybe you're in Ontario, Canada, and you take a survey, and it's people in the less populated, Yukon region of Canada also take the same survey, but there's way less people in Yukon than Ontario. There's a disparity between the populations of the North and South, but you can kind of compare the two still because they're both stratified. I guess that's it.
All right. Mr. Miles is just filled with questions today because you have another question. Which kind of average would give me the best way to compare the performance of two classes of a required math course and why? So, I'll answer that. I would say the mean, other than the median, will be the best average you can use. And the reason I say that is because the median only gives you a point where there's a few above this number and a few more below that number, whereas a mean is the average, the actual average of the class's the class's math course. So I would say the mean is the right way to go.
Yeah.
So
same.
This is Mr. Miles' last question.
Last question.
What does the author mean on page 45 when he says, and we're getting a quote out, when he says, hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way, just as 100 tall stipendies will rarely come up exactly 50 heads and 50 tails. So basically what he's trying to say is when you're looking for something, you're not going to get exactly what you expect. Like when you toss a coin for like 50 times, you're not going to exactly get 25 heads and 25 tails. You're going to get maybe around that number, but you're not going to exactly get that number. So,
if you're striving to be normal, there's no real thing as normal.
There's no normal.
Normal is really just based on your perspective. So,
yeah. It's an
Those are the questions from Podcast 1. Stay tuned for the questions from Podcast 2.
Thanks.
We're back, and we're going to be answering the questions from Podcast number 2. Question number 1. Jules, do you care to read it out?
Sure. Okay. So, Mr. Miles asked the first question. He said, the author suggests that some reported differences may not be real differences at all. Others, even though they can be shown to be real differences, should still be ignored. Explain how each of these two situations can arise and give an example of each.
So what I think this means is that, when you take a sample for making statistics there are lots of things that you're looking for, but there might be some small variations in the statistic itself. We're working for the car company Honda, and we say that 20% of people that buy Honda cars buy Honda Civics. That's the number we're looking at. But within that number, there's some slight variation. Some are blue, some are green, some are red. But that's not what we're looking at, so that's something that can be ignored. But overall, 20% buy the Civic. yeah, that, you know, it's just an example of like something small that will be picked up on when you survey people, but it's not quite necessary in sort of displaying the information gathered.
Okay, so Mr. Miles, next question is, what is a semi-attached figure? So he's basing that off of chapter 7, which is called the semi-attached figure. And what I've learned from this chapter, that a semi-attached figure is a figure, a number that is misleading, or a figure that is misleading to a statement, basically, but it relates to some parts of the statement, but it doesn't relate all the way. So it's a very misleading statement, basically. And on page, I think it's on page 79, there is a quote, and it said, well, they give an example, and it said, it was reported that the number of deaths chargeable to steam railroads in one recent year was 4,712. And they go on to say that this is a very misleading statement, because, I mean, it's semi-true there was that many, but they're making it seem like these people jump in front of the railroads and die like that, where that's not even the case, because most of them were actually on board. So, yeah. Well, not most of them. 131, or 32 was on board. But, you know, basically what I'm trying to say is they're misleading, saying everybody jumped in front of the railroad that year.
Right.
So, Mr. Miles' next question is, what does post hoc mean? So, thank you, Mr. Miles, for helping me out with this question. But post hoc is basically arguing that because something occurred, well, okay, without doing experiment, basically, you assume that something caused something to happen. Let's say, for example, you're saying you were sick one week, and then the next week you weren't sick. And you think about everything that you did during that week, something you did differently, and assume that's the reason I'm not sick. For example, that week that you were sick, you went outside that whole week that you were sick. The week that you weren't sick, you didn't go outside. So now you're assuming because you didn't go outside, that made you not sick anymore. So,
yeah. Cool. Okay.
So, Mr. Miles, last question is, list several kinds of correlation that might lead to post hoc reasoning. So, I guess I just gave you one.
Let's just come up with one more.
Yeah, one more.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take bullying.
Bullying, great topic.
Example. So, there's this child name, I don't know. Adam. And he was bullied for his whole entire middle school year. And during that year, he would wear Adidas, for a second.
Mm-hmm.
He went into high school, and he stopped wearing Adidas. He started wearing Nike.
Right.
Now that he's wearing Nike, he's not being bullied anymore. So, now Adam is thinking, I wonder why they stopped bullying me. I went from wearing Adidas to wearing Nike, and now all of a sudden, they're not bullying me anymore. That is a post hoc.
Great. Okay. Yeah. So let's move on to the misleading graphs that we found ourselves. I found a post on Forbes.com, the popular financial publication, Forbes, specifically about misleading graphs. So it was, you know, very, very helpful. And, you know, a lot of them, the first few examples are, you know, sales examples for companies. And sometimes it looks like the bars are constantly raising throughout the years. You know, through 2006 through 2011, there's like, you know, a steady increase in profit, but that's all about the scale. You know, So on some of them, there's just no scale even depicted. But on the other one, there's, you know, a scale, whatever, every $50 million it goes up. And that, you know, I guess really just changes how the graphs, you know, are perceived and how they're viewed by the common people like us. Yeah. So Jules, what was your example?
Okay, so my example came from Statistics How To, and this site gave me different examples of how statistics can be misleading. One thing that really stood out to me was the Colgate advertisement. On the sign, it said more than 80% of dentists recommend Colgate. I thought that was interesting because, you know, brush my teeth with Colgate, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on to read it, and it said, but something that you don't know, that these dentists, they were trying out multiple toothpastes. So, like, just because these dentists recommend Colgate, 80%, the 20% recommended other brands. And, I mean, this is something that you don't, like, you don't keep track of, even though, like, 20% recommended other brands, a part of that 80% could have recommended the other brands, too. This doesn't mean they all recommended just one. They could have recommended any of them.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, I hear those statistics all the time. You know, you see commercials like 9 out of 10 dentists choose, whatever, Orbit gum.
Right. These kind of misleading statistics was actually banned by the Advertising Standards Authority.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, so, yeah, let's, you know, we're running up on the 15-minute mark. Let's kind of go through the last few chapters of the book.
Sure.
We finished the book this week, so we're going to go over chapters 9 and 10. Chapter 9 was a little bit longer than normal, I think. But it was definitely very informative. So the first sort of example they talk about is a darkening shadow over different states in the United States, showing how much the federal government spending is in reference to like how much each state makes. So the picture here, the top picture, shows every state west of the Mississippi except for part of Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana. All of them are you know, shaded in because the incomes of those states equal the amount of spending the federal government does. But, you know, that's a really compelling graph, but, you know, the states take up a lot of space, but there's not a lot of people. Underneath it, it shows the same population density as, you know, pretty much half of the United States, but only, you know, in New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Jersey, and New England. And that's not really a very powerful graph, you know, as a viewer or as a person trying to, you know, talk about how much money is being spent and scare people.
I think that's a good explanation of chapter 9. I think you can go on to chapter 10.
You want to go on to chapter 10?
Unless you have something else you want to say?
I mean, I don't know. They kind of use a lot of examples in chapter 9. I liked the one right after the United States one about the family income. And it says, in 1949, the Bureau of the Census said that the income of the average family was $3,100. But a different foundation, the Russell Sage Foundation, said that the average income was $5,004. And that's because you take the total income of the United States and divide it by the population, average it out, and get $1,251. And say for a family of four, that becomes $5,004. So it's really about how you find your averages. Let's move on to chapter 10.
Okay, so in chapter 10, what I found interesting is they gave you a list of questions that you basically you need to think about when you're dealing with statistics. So the first question is, who says so? So, you know, like when you read something in a magazine or you're recommended something in a commercial or something, you see this doctor in a white coat and she or he is talking about how great this product is. But you really need to know who this person is. And another thing they actually went on to talk about is colleges. Like, a researcher from... I'm trying to find the example. They said a researcher from...
I think it was Cornell, right?
Oh, yes, Cornell University. Yeah. So, basically, they're using Cornell University as their person, basically. And but Cornell really doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just the fact that this person is from Cornell.
Right, didn't the survey was taken from students at Cornell, but right. The findings were summarized by someone not from Cornell. But because, you know, it says, you know, it's sort of displayed as Cornell University did this study.
Yeah.
But it's not actually Cornell doing the study. It's just the students that go to Cornell.
Right. So another question they asked is, how does he know? So basically, what they're trying to tell you to do is figure out, like, what was their experiment? Their experiment seemed to be logical. Did it have any errors or anything that could affect their results in anything? And another question that I found interesting was, what's misleading? Like, when they give out your averages, is it a mean? Is it a median? And does it provide enough information for you to say, oh, okay, this seems reasonable?
Go team.
That's
Project Everbet.
Well, you know, so that's the book. This is our last episode of How to Lie with Statistics.
Hi, Jules and Max.
And I'm Max, and thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.